mess. With politics and taxes and people grinding axes, there's no happiness. Zoom, 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 rhythm, lead your race. The future doesn't fret me as long as I can get me someone to slap that bass. Happiness is.
Welcome to the amazing voice of Spider Saloff. My voice is that of Rick Kogan. Welcome to After Hours. I once said about Spider, who is sitting within feet of me, if there's a greater, more electric and sensitive singer on the planet than Spider Saloff, my ears eagerly await. Whenever I wrote that, Spider, my ears are still eagerly awaiting. You are just the best. You'll hear a lot of Spider singing, but you're mostly going to hear her talking high.
Hi, Rick. And speaking of incredible voices, yours is meow.
Yeah. 40 years of smoking and drinking, you too.
You've got it right.
All you young broadcasters out there thinking, well, I want to be on the radio. Start hanging out at the Billy Goat. You just got an astonishing, I think, award at the 32nd Annual Bistro Awards Gala. What are the Bistro Awards, and what did you get?
Okay, the Bistro Awards, it's a very cool award because it is really, I think, the only one of its kind, the first one of its kind, that is specifically for live entertainment. And it is given to live performers that are either in nightclub performers, comedians, any kind of live performance, and the former recipients include people like Lainey Kazan, Ben Vereen, John Hendricks. It's pretty amazing, and it's not a nominated award. They call you up and they tell you you have the award.
Okay, who called you? When did you get the call, and what was your reaction?
Okay, it was Sherry Eaker, who I have known forever. Her father created Backstage Magazine, which is the Bible of the theater industry in New York. And she created the Bistro Awards. And she is just this amazing, like, talent scout of talent and champion of the arts. And I've known her for a long time. And I really, ever since I haven't lived in New York, you kind of feel like you're forgotten from that scene.
Of course, yeah.
And I got two rave reviews when I was there in October last year. And I got this phone call from her shortly after the first of the year that floored me.
And she said,
you're getting Bistro Award for ongoing jazz artistry. Can you be there and will you perform? And I'm like, what?
Yeah, twist.
Like me? Ow!
Yeah,
yes,
twist my arm.
And
twist my arm.
Exactly. And the Lifetime Achievement always goes to someone incredibly amazing. And this year it was for Darlene Love.
Wow.
And so I was very, very thrilled about this and honored. And
is it a bunch of people getting
awards?
Yes, how many people
there were
got
like,
awards?
I think there were 16 recipients.
Wow.
And they were a real wide range of talents, like comedians and, you know, singers and Broadway people. Another one of the greats that closed the show was Carol Woods, who's a Broadway star. And it was an amazing evening. And I saw so many people that I hadn't seen for so long from New York. And it was a glorious evening. And we all performed. Everybody that gets an award performs. So it's quite a star-studded event. And
I'll bet. Where is the event?
This year, and I believe last year as well, it was at Gotham Comedy Club on 28th Street. And it was it's a perfect space because it's a theater, but it has, like, you know, cocktail seating and
my preferred seating
flying in there, and it was amazing. But the craziest thing that happened was the blizzard was coming the day of the awards.
Oh my God! Right, sure.
So Sherry said they literally had to rewrite the show three times because they're dealing with nine million people, and the blizzard was coming. So that day at rehearsal, my flight was canceled, so I wasn't getting out the next morning as I was supposed to. And then Darlene Love was supposed to close the show with Paul Schaefer not only introducing her but playing for her and giving a long speech. And he had to get to the West Coast the next day, so they opened the show so Paul Schaefer could get out.
Wow.
and then the fabulous Carol Woods closed the show.
Doing something like that, Spider, I know it's I know you're humbled by that kind of thing, but doesn't it also tell you in a very powerful way that live performance is still alive,
makes you
so
feel like
to speak.
It matters.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, and the reception you get and the people that were in the room, they were all, the recipients as well as the audience, they were from a complete different background. I mean, like, all ages, all shapes and sizes, but people that are passionate about live performance. And it just made you, it just felt like the place was brimming with life. It was exciting and wonderful.
You know, do you get a sense, you've been performing for a while.
400 years, now, yes.
Mm-hmm. For a while.
Yeah.
Do you get a sense, and I do kind of, that there is a kind of resurrection of live performance going on here, because I think the world has become so icy. We communicate mm-hmm. in increasingly icy ways. We can sit home and watch virtually everything we want to watch on TV, but there is that need for human contact. Am I just dreaming,
or do you sense that? I think you're absolutely right, and one of the odd techno signs of this is that the interest in things that are streamed live, like things that are put on Facebook that somebody just shoots.
Yeah.
It is the passion for seeing something that's real, that isn't really a reality, non-reality show that's been staged and rehearsed.
Of course.
It is something that is spontaneous. Mm. And the spontaneity of life itself and the spontaneity of performance, I think there is a resurgence in live performance. I mean, so many music festivals, I mean, are packed because people want to see something in reality.
Well, and I also think they want to see there's that the community that's formed, the same kind of community that you know, cave people gathered around
the fire. Yeah, like-minded people are getting the excitement, the human energy of something that's happening in front of your face that will never be duplicated.
You did. You must have at some point, and you and I have seen, you know, dozens of clubs close here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think we both experienced a kind of downturn in that where people didn't seem to want to go out. But I really do think this is a new kind of, if not a golden age, at least a kind of silver age of people.
Maybe a
bronze
sort age. Of bronze age, yeah.
Bronze age. We're going to spend this whole hour, ladies and gentlemen, with Spider Saylov. I may have some commercials to read, but I don't have them, so we'll figure that out. I may. Tom Hush, the producer who's taken over for Elif Garris, will be in here shortly. You're going to hear a lot of music from Spider. Her website, by the way, which has a ton of information and it's a good, solid website. It's Spider, SpiderSalOff.com. You can see her whole schedule, but we're also going to talk about this schedule. What did you sing at this 32nd annual Bistro Awards Gala?
Actually, I did the song that you opened with, Slap That Bass, a lead into Willow Weep for Me, because they both had to do with George Gershwin.
Oh, how nice.
Mm-hmm.
See, the other great thing about you is you have such affection and have, in your fashion, are keeping alive the Great American Songbook.
Oh, my greatest
call
wish.
You're crazy about Cole Porter. We'll take a break.
Okay.
We'll hear some more music, and we'll talk more about your life and time. Spider will be appearing at the at that cabaret bash at Park West in a couple weeks, but also in Florida at Jazz Fest and at Ravinia. We're going to talk about all of that after I tell you this, that there's a new team coming to town, the WGN Evening News Team at 4. That sounds like an afternoon news team, but join Ben Bradley, Lourdes Duarte, Demetrius Ivory, and Jared Payton weekdays at 4 starting Tuesday on WGN Television.
Whenever skies look gray to me and trouble begins,
was indeed a great songwriter, but no one makes him sound better than my guest Spider Saylor. You love Cole Porter, though, don't you?
Oh, adore Cole Porter and love the story of his life.
And the Gershwins.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
So many others. When you think of another thing, Spider, as a jazz performer, you can never, it's impossible to sing a song the same way twice, is it not?
Oh, yes.
I mean, you are changing. It
performing
is
in the jazz genre, you're never going to have a repeat performance. Everything is always different. And it depends on who is with you, who's playing with you, the way you're feeling that particular time, the way your audience is reacting, especially and if you're in a recording situation, that's different as well.
And not to get too philosophical about it, but it's also the way you have lived with some of these songs, with the lyrics of these songs for decades now.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, totally.
Your feelings about the lyrics and even the meaning of a lyric changes, does it not?
Oh, yes. And sometimes I will think about a song and I'm like, oh no, that means this. Like, one of my revelations was when I was doing the Chet Baker show with James Gavin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And we were doing it on tour and we kept adding songs to it. And we put in the song around midnight and I'm like, this song is about addiction. And now every time I sing it, it is about addiction to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And now when I interpret the lyrics, I always think about that, and it gives it this whole other level of consciousness that is like, this person isn't going to make it past midnight. You have to have that.
Yeah.
You know, and understanding, you know, whatever it means to you, too. I mean, so many of the great standards, like these beautiful love songs, there are dark places in there.
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
And
when you're going through a personal tragedy, it's pretty amazing what the strength you can get out of.
You know, I'm going to play near the end when I say goodnight to you, and it's almost its entirety, how long has this been going on, which I find one of the most, there are about 800 levels to that song,
Oh, yeah. It is one of my very, very favorite Gershwin tunes, and the lyric is unbelievable. It's sassy and smart.
How did you, as long as we have known each other, and as many times as I've seen you perform, how did you come to music? This is not a general question I ask in a saloon after saying you're the greatest singer
I've
ever
heard. When I was a little kid, I just loved music. I would love it. I would go off and, you know, in the back room and
where did you
dance
grow up?
Around in the mirror outside of Philadelphia in the suburbs. And my parents loved music. I remember when, as a teenager, my parents were older than most kids' parents were. I was the youngest kid, and I didn't really like pop music. I used to pretend I did, but I would really sneak off and listen to my dad's Benny Goodman albums and Billie Holiday albums.
Is that right?
And I was about, you know, 10.
And he was simply a fan.
He, you know, was a guy from the 40s that loved popular, what to him was popular music. He didn't particularly even think
Billie
of it
Holiday,
as
though. Billie Holiday is a
man,
very, my
I'm,
father was crazy about her,
oh,
too.
Man.
But that's a very specific taste, you know.
And I would cry to that music and just feel so, you know, emotionally touched by everything I was listening to. It would give me joy and tears and it was just so emotional for me. And then, and
so you started singing with these record albums, as they used to call.
Oh, yeah, they were records.
They were record albums.
Big old LPs.
When did you start singing beyond that?
I told my parents I was going to be in a school variety show when I was 14. And they said, doing what? And I said, singing.
Striptease.
But I wasn't going to tell them because I would rehearse at my girlfriend's house with a record to Barbara Streisand singing I'm the Greatest Star.
Oh, my God.
And my parents weren't allowed to hear it because I knew they would tell me I couldn't do it.
Why do you think they'd tell you that?
Because they were afraid I would fail. And music was foreign to them. I mean, anything other than retail was foreign to them. And so they came to the show and they were like, what planet did she come from? Like,
whose daughter are
strange.
You? Whose daughter
and
are you?
And by the time I was 16, I was in a professional theater company. And I did summer stock, and it was shocking. I mean, I was like somebody from another planet in my family. Nobody had.
Did you take voice lessons and
not at
study?
That point.
Wow.
And I actually, my studies later in college were theater. I didn't study music.
Did you study theater to do musical theater?
Actually, for straight-ahead acting, but I ended up working in musical theater because I could sing. Yeah,
I also think that acting experience, there is, if anybody thinks that someone can perform without having, and I've seen it happen in even the greatest singer, there's a theatricality to any singer's performance, or there should be. Do you agree with that?
You have to know how to interpret the lyric. You've got to know what you're what story are you telling?
Right.
Which is why someone that doesn't have a great instrument, who is hailed as one of the greatest singers of all time, Fred Astaire, knew how to phrase, knew how to tell a story, understood timing, understood rhythm. There are so many elements to this, but you have to be able to tell your listener, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Am I just going blah, 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 blah? You need
to
know that breath is there because of what you're feeling. You know, you're not saying, whenever skies are gray to me.
Yeah.
That is different than just going, whenever skies are gray to me. That's just the notes. You need to know what
the story
is. When
did you first perform in a nightclub?
Oh, okay. My first solo performance in a nightclub was in 1985.
Where?
And it was at the Five Oaks, which was an old nightclub from the 1700s in New York. And I had worked there as a bartender. And that was during my stay in the theater, I was doing a lot of musicals that were out of town. And then I started to kind of check out nightclubs. And I was in a vocalese group called Vito's Necktie. They were like Manhattan Transfer type thing.
Vito's
Necktie, yeah.
That's a great name.
But that didn't last very long. And then I said, I want to keep doing this. So I produced my own show at the Five Oaks. And it was in March of 1985. And it was the scariest, most thrilling, exciting thing I had ever done in my life. And then I was bitten. And
That could not be too much before I first saw you. How did you get to Chicago?
Well, I didn't come to Chicago until New Year's of 1991.
Okay.
I did a one-nighter. The Gold Star Sardine Bar brought me in for New Year's Eve. And I was literally here for 4 days. And then Bill Allen, the darling.
How did Bill find you? Bill Allen is a guy who was a partner in the Treasure Island grocery store chain. And the Treasure Island built a place in what was in the 666 building, and there was like an empty space that didn't fit, and he turned it into the Gold Star Sardine Bar, arguably the coolest nightclub.
Magical.
The smallest.
Yeah.
But also the coolest nightclub in the history of
Magical.
Chicago.
And had the Count Basie band there.
Yeah,
and
everybody there.
And Tony Bennett. And
Julie Wilson.
And Liza Minnelli.
Yeah.
It was actually through Julie Wilson and Bobby Short that Bill Allen became aware of me. Julie Wilson was my darling. She was
a great woman.
She was, you know, oh God, I love Julie Wilson.
Great woman.
And Bobby Short knew me from New York, and he was also owners of the Gold
Julie
Star.
Julie Wilson and Bobby Short told Bill Allen to bring you.
They
into
kind of
the
gave him the nod, and then Bill
God.
Kept calling me for about a year and wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
He'd just chat with me on the phone. So I did New Year's Eve. Then a year and a half later, he had me do a month, the month of October, and then 2 months later, he called me up and said, what would you think about playing here on a regular basis and moving to Chicago?
Wow.
And I said, when? And he said, next week.
Yeah, now. Yeah,
and
that's the way Bill operated.
I moved here.
Wow.
I moved here.
Wow. Did you know anything about the scene in Chicago or know any
people?
Well,
the time that I played for a month,
you met.
I kind of got to check it out,
sure,
and see what it would be like to live here. And then I'm in love with this city. I will never leave until they force me.
That must be when I first saw you, because I adored the Gold Star Sardine.
Oh, and it had to be 93 when I first moved here. Yeah,
and Bill. I'm talking this whole hour with Spider Saloff. You can get a ton of information about Spider at her website, which is really nice. You can hear her music and buy her music, Spider. SpiderSaloof.com. We'll talk more about her career. We finally got her to Chicago. Now she is in Chicago ladies and gentlemen, and we will carry on from there. We'll get some news and you'll get some commercials because that's how we are able to obviously stay on the air. Spider, this is so much fun. It's unbelievable that all the time I've known you, I never knew, like, how you started singing.
Crazy stuff.
I know, but I would always just say, oh my God, you're the greatest singer I've ever seen. But I used to drink at the Gold Star Theater. So. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. It's 9:30, and one of the great radio guests in history, Roger Badish, will bring you the news. I'm here with Spider Saloff. If you've been listening, we've got her to Chicago. She's been a sensation at the Gold Star Sardine Bar. And if any of you remember that, and I know there must be dozens, if not hundreds of you going, oh, I love that place. I love that place. You fell in love with Chicago because of that place, but also because of the community you met here. I have always found that the cabaret jazz community in this town is as nurturing. You know, you think of a guy like, Bobby Lewis, who's now in his 80s, who is still playing and everywhere nurturing and as nice a human being as there is on this planet. That's part of the reason you stayed, right?
Incredible players. Actually, some of my favorite jazz musicians that I've ever worked with are here, and they're still playing. And, I mean, there are guys that I won't get to work with for a long time, and then I will. Jeremy Kahn is one of my very, very favorite collaborators in the world, and I met him here. I met just last night. I got to work with Steve Million and Eric Hochberg, who are absolute jewels of the community, who I hadn't worked with forever. And I mean, like, the wealth of music that is available here, and the wealth of art. I mean, the incredible theater experiences here.
And there are jerks in any business, whether it's theater or journalism or radio or jazz, but I don't know many.
I would say not in the field I work in. They are few and far between all over the world. I mean, a lot of guys in New York that I worked with forever, guys on the West Coast. I will call people up that I hadn't worked with in 5 years, and they're like, oh, man, I'm so glad to hear from you. Yeah, let's go do it.
Wow.
Or guys I don't know. I'm going to Washington, D.C. in May, and I called a guy that was recommended. He was an absolute love. He's a monster player. I can't wait to work with him. A guy named Wade Beach that I'll be playing with in D.C.
And well, you're going down next week.
Oh, to Florida,
You're
going to
be in Florida for a couple things. You're going to be doing a Cole Porter celebration and then a Mark Knadler's Cole Porter soiree. When you get back, you're going to be at this new club.
Winter's Jazz Club
Tell the people about Winter's Jazz Club.
It is the
hippest
place.
I know Howard Reich's written about it, but it's new.
It's a beautiful, magical place. It's on the riverfront. It's right downtown. And it's between Hubbard and Illinois, like on the Riverwalk.
411 East Illinois,
On the Riverwalk. And it's beautiful and glamorous, and it's a listening room. It's a room where you just go to drink glamorous cocktails and hear great music, and everybody listens, and it's a beautiful, attentive room. It's a gorgeous environment. The sound system is lovely. And I'm going to be there on April 19th with Pete Benson and the fabulous Eric Schneider. And
we're
doing a tribute to Duke Ellington all evening. So it'll be a trip. And I played there in December. Absolutely loved it. It's a magical room. It's one of the great Chicago spaces.
Whose room is it?
It's actually.
It's okay. We don't need.
Forget. No. Yeah. It is a new club owner. Someone that's passionate.
You would have to be. I mean, new clubs have sort of come and gone here. You've got a venerable place like Davenport's, and good old Joe Siegel and his son are been running the showcase forever.
But it's not someone that's a former owner.
It's just someone with a passion.
A pioneer that really did this right. And
well, see, it goes to our theory that no one would open a new club if they didn't think people were going out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it goes to the Saloff-Kogan theory that people are going out and want that.
So
kind
you build
of
it,
thing.
They will come. They will come. But actually, this was going to open last summer.
Yeah.
And because of construction, because it was a new place, it
sure.
didn't open till November.
Wow.
So it took a while, which meant that the, you know, the Riverwalk traffic wasn't going to be happening.
Yeah,
but,
right. Well, this summer it should go crazy.
I was
don't
delighted
you think?
To play there in December. It was really magical, and I'm excited that I'll be able to be there in April. April, May, and June, I'll be there one night of each month. So it should be a blast.
Oh, interesting. And then you've got coming up, as always, you're doing Ravinia again, aren't you? What are you doing
at Ravinia? Yes, I'm so excited. It's a debut of a new concert called The Cool Heat of Peggy Lee. And Jeremy Kahn and I are collaborating on this. And it'll be a whole tribute to Peggy Lee and to her style and stories of her very fascinating life.
Oh, no
and,
question.
It'll be a blast. I'm very excited about that. And that'll be August 25th at
the
Ravinia.
Jazz Fest, too.
And I'm going to be part of the Jazz Festival this year with the Ella Fitzgerald tribute that will be in September. And I don't have a lot of details yet, but I know my two favorite Ella partners in the world will be in it, Frida Lee and Dee Alexander,
oh,
as well
neat.
As another all-star cast. And it'll be exciting. So,
what do you think, Spider Sail, if you do have a way of sort of hooking or identifying that I would go see any show in this world that was just Spider Saloff sings. But it is necessary, don't you think, in this society we live in, to hook your shows and your singing on either a famous composer or a famous performer to give new people a kind of frame
oh,
of reference.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to...
Talk to me about that. It's a kind of marketing thing, isn't it?
It will attract more interest because, I mean... I don't know. How many times do you go somewhere? I mean, I am not someone that is a household word by any means, by any wild imagination.
You should be. But,
if you include what the point of interest is going to be, it is going to, you know, fascinate new listeners, hopefully, and also educate people, you know, people
sure.
that may have... You know, young listeners or new listeners that say didn't know, they know of the name Cole Porter, but they don't know about it. And then they hear the stories about when the person becomes someone they know,
sure.
which I feel like they're all friends of mine.
Yeah. Oh,
these
no,
were
you,
all
as
people
well, you should,
that
sure.
I feel not only attached to the music, but because of who they were, you know, and what they did and how they created, how they plowed through whatever they had to do, you know, to get the word out there. It's exciting.
And it's also, it goes to your theatrical background, too, that these concerts become, not that you're not more than enough on your own, but they become theatrical in a sense.
Oh, that's
right?
What I love, is telling the stories, making the music come alive because you know, do you know what happened when this person wrote this song? Do you know what was going on? That's the way I love to approach this, to
sure.
tell the story. And when I did the Bistro Awards, going back to that, I was supposed to do one song, and I was going to do Slap That Bass. Then they said, we want you to do two. And what I did was I bridged the song Willow Weep For Me that was written about George Gershwin.
Wow.
Anne Ronell, who pined for him her entire life, wrote Willow Weep For Me. So I told the story as it went into the other tune. And it makes it much more powerful to know, why did someone write this? Why did they do it?
I could not agree with you more. I absolutely could not agree with you more. It's Tom Michael and Becky Menzie, who of course you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Doing a Saturday show during April at Davenport's that is focused on famous duos, Steve and Edie, duos that have survived. God, those guys were together for 54 years. And people like Simon and Garfunkel, who didn't work out so well, who did
but
not.
But the combination is still
magical.
It's fun. Yeah.
When I think, you know, I don't, maybe that's one of the reasons that you are continuing and even more successful than ever, is that this... It's a full, not that music on its own doesn't do it, but it's a full kind of show where people leave not just being entertained, but being kind of enlightened.
Yeah, a human experience. I mean, it's about people and emotions and feelings and things that happened, where that's going to be more relatable to anyone. You want to be touched as a human being and feel like, wait, this is my experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you put that so well. A better website for Spider Saloff is, in case you have trouble spelling,
an easy one to remember.
It's Spider Jazz. Now, I'm not even going to spell it for you. SpiderJazz.com. You get all sorts of information. We're going to take a break. Spider and I are going to talk some more, and then I'm going to allow you, ladies and gentlemen, to hear the entire version of How Long Has This Been Going On, written by a couple of brothers who, you know, one of the amazing things is, good God, can you imagine what George Gershwin might have done had he not died in his 30s?
Really?
It's mind-boggling.
Oh, unbelievable.
He was 30, I think
39.
He was 38 or 9.
39.
Yeah. 39 years old.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. We'll be right back. Welcome back. There was no musical bump coming back because I am going to allow you to hear an entire Spider Saloff song. Spider, you sing because you have to, don't you?
Absolutely. I can't stop.
You
cannot
stop.
Yeah, love it.
You can get all the information that you haven't got. You won't hear a lot of stories on her website about the Gold Star Sardine Bar or Philadelphia, but you can get a lot more information and see her schedule and buy her CDs and a lot of other stuff at spiderjazz.com. And now, honey, it was great to see you.
This was wonderful,
really,
Rick. What a treat.
You are really a treasure. You are really a treasure.
Aww.
And go to one of the places. This new place sounds too good. Winters Jazz Club, 411 East Illinois Street, the new hot place in town. She'll be there one day a month for the rest of her life. It's great to see you, sweetie.
Thank you, Rick.
Great to see you. And now I want to treat you, ladies and gentlemen, to a full version of Spider Saloff. Here she is doing that collaboration by a couple guys named the Gershwin Brothers.
Neath the stars at bazaars, often I've had to caress men. $5 or $10 then I'd collect from all those yes men. Don't be sad, I must add that they meant no more than chessmen. Darling, can't you see? 'Twas for charity. Though these lips have made slips, I was never really serious. Who'd have thought I'd be brought to a state that's so delirious? Tears. Where have I I creep. That divine rendezvous. Don't. It for what a break, for heaven's sake, how long has this been going on? How long has this been going on?
Spider Saloff, go to spiderjazz.com to learn even more about her. There you've got some insight into how lovely and talented she is. I'm going to have, sitting here now, he can't talk now because it's not time for him, is Peter Kahn, one of the three editors of a fantastic, and I mean fantastic, book called The Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks. He has, and he and my old friend Patricia Smith and Ravi Shankar, not that Ravi Shankar, have collected, I don't know, dozens, if not hundreds, I don't know, it's dozens, certainly, of poems in honor of the great, great Gwendolyn Brooks, who was also not a friend of mine, but a friend of my dad's, and a sweet, wonderful, wonderful woman and grand talent. It's her centennial, so we'll talk a great deal about the book. I might convince Peter to read a poem. I found one I'm going to read. It's not that long, so stay tuned. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. Peter Kahn is a English teacher at Oak Park River Forest High School, and that's where he was in 1996 when he was, he had a streak. Peter, you had a streak of like never missing a day.
Correct.
Didn't you? Until you had to miss a day, and you did it kind of joyfully, didn't you? Why?
Well, I wasn't going to miss the day. My boss asked me to go to the NCTE conference, and I said, I can't do it.
Again, I have never missed a day.
And she said, well, you'd be hosting Gwendolyn Brooks. And I said,
I'll get a sub.
Yep.
Peter is one of the three editors, along with Ravi Shankar, not the, the Beatles guru, and Patricia Smith, my old friend from the Sun-Times and one of America's leading poets, both on the page. And if you have ever seen her in performance, perhaps the leading performance poet in, certainly in America, they put together something called the Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks. This is, of course, the 100th anniversary of the birth of Gwendolyn Brooks, who was born in Topeka and came here pretty soon, and in her fashion and through her poetry helped define Chicago. Meeting Miss Brooks, as everybody in the world used to call her, Peter, that was the spark of this notion, of this idea for a book, was it not, even though it was 20-some years ago that you met her?
Well, getting to spend the day, I got to host her at this conference, and to witness her in action was pretty remarkable.
Let me ask you beforehand, you obviously knew who she was.
I did, though.
Were you a huge fan of her poetry, or...
Quraysh Ali Lansana introduced me to her work in the early 90s, and he used to do a workshop on We Real Cool.
Yeah.
So I started using that to teach my students about enjambment.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a fan, but getting to see her in person made me more than just a fan.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Made me a fanatic of sorts.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, I mean, I met her as a young man and just thought, this is like the nicest... You know, the thing about Gwendolyn, and I hate to be that familiar, she was a great friend of my mother and father, is there was something quietly regal about her. Is that sound, is that an accurate kind of, would you give me an,
I would agree. Yeah. From what I saw. You know, I certainly didn't know her well at all, but from what I witnessed, that would do
well,
the trick.
Well, in some ways, though, you get to meeting her is knowing her, and her poems through her poetry, you do get to know her too. Mm-hmm. So you then, many years later, 14 years later, start studying with someone named Terrence Hayes. Don't
Correct.
You? And that changes your life, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
How so?
I got to spend a week studying with him at Provincetown Arts Center. And, I mean, the man's a genius. So I learned an awful lot from him. But in the preparation for it, I read his most recent book at the time, Lighthead. And in it, I stumbled upon this poem, The Golden Shovel. And as I was reading it, something was very familiar. And I started looking at his enjambment, his line breaks. And I felt like I solved an interesting puzzle, because Down the Right Margin was Real Cool in its entirety.
He invented this form,
he
which
did.
Is called the Golden Shovel.
Correct.
Explain it a bit. I get it. And when you read the poem, you totally get it. But I think it's one of the great literary innovations that I've ever encountered.
Yeah, it's incredible, right? Because you're paying homage to another writer while creating your own work. And one of the things I love about it as an educator is it kind of evens the playing field. So if I mention Sonnet or if I mention Sistina, students break out in a cold sweat, right?
Or fall
as
asleep.
Did I,
yeah,
or
yeah.
fall asleep, right?
Or fall asleep, yeah.
Golden Shovel is an intriguing title right off the bat. And then when I explain that you're borrowing from somebody else to help you write your own poem, suddenly it becomes less of a foreboding task to write a piece of poetry.
Well, and your students, I would always, and I have ever argued that that song lyrics are poems. I have ever argued that, whether it's Muddy Waters or Tupac Shakur or certainly Ira Gershwin. And the kids can now access those things rather than being caught in the old dusty kind of bookshelves, can't they?
Mm-hmm.
And that really must give them a jolt.
Yeah. So, you know, the way I originally taught it is I taught some Gwendolyn Brooks, I taught Terrence Hayes, and then I said, all right, here's the form. Here's how you use it. You can go ahead and use favorite line from a book, a favorite line from a song, and make it your own.
Is it always right hand?
Well,
let's explain.
As we interpret
it. You're the teacher. You're going to explain to the people out there exactly what it is.
Sure. So the original Golden Shovel poem, after Gwendolyn Brooks, was written by Terrence Hayes, as we said, and he embedded in the Down the Right Margin the entire poem "We Real Cool." So his first line ended with "We," second line "Real Cool," and so on and so forth. So for the sake of this anthology, when we approached writers, we said you can either take a line or an entire poem by Ms. Brooks, and in certain occasions from another writer who you really respect or love, and you will embed that down the right margin of your piece. Now, Terrence played with the form in his book a little bit, so we gave some creative leeway there. And then you have someone like Patricia Smith, also a genius.
Yes.
And you look at her poem, and what she did is it ran down. She took the entire last quatrain of the Ballad of Emmett Till, ran it down the right margin, but simultaneously ran it up the left margin.
Well, see, that's what makes Patty Ann a genius.
I mean,
that
unbelievable.
She is. Genius that she is. You got for this. So about, I don't know, 4 years ago, you decide or get...
About 6 years ago.
How did the idea... I can imagine, but I'd like to hear from you. You said, oh, my God, Miss Brooks' 100th centennial is coming up, and maybe I should do something.
Well, to be honest, I
simple?
Thought it would be out long before her centennial.
Of course, everybody. Yes,
so
talk to every book editor. Right.
My mind. No,
but how did the notion, what sparked it?
Well... You know, studying with Terrence and then testing the form out with sophomores. So I worked with all the sophomores in the, so 750 sophomores in Oak Park over time, right, in all their English classes. And with some students who were really reticent to do any poetry during the week that I was in there, this form got them. So I had this
because
idea.
It's a challenge of sorts, is it not?
It
and
is.
And it's also, tell me I'm wrong again, Peter, about this, but... It's also a game of sorts. It's a puzzle.
It is. And yeah. Again, when I solved it that first time, so to speak, it was fun. It was exciting.
Yeah.
So, and you know, just like a well-written sonnet, you don't necessarily know it's a sonnet. And with the Golden Shovel poems, like if I didn't tell you what Patricia did with her poem, you would have just thought this is a brilliant poem. But then when you see how she did that and executed it, then it's beyond brilliant.
Well, one of the other great things about this book, and again, the book is the Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks, is the quality of the work in here is, I certainly commend you for getting the people you did, but it's almost scary good to me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think people, probably because it's honoring Ms. Brooks, people took a lot of care in the poems that they sent us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Patricia took 3 or 4 months to work on this poem. Every week she'd say, "It's coming, Peter, it's coming." But it took her that long, and it's because she wanted to really get it right, as she obviously did.
It's an incredible, incredible accomplishment. You and I are going to be here for the whole hour. We're going to talk after the break to one of the people involved in, because it's a Gwendolyn Brooks fest in this town, as well it should be, to one of the professors involved in the Centennial Brooks, a 3-day celebration of her legacy at the DuSable Museum and at the Logan Center, and you can join in that conversation. I don't know the guy. If he's a professor at the UFC, he's got to be smart enough to talk to us, don't you think?
I would imagine.
Don't you think? We'll be back shortly after I tell you that Chicago is best, right? Hit up Facebook and tell Chicago's Best TV where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best Sundays at 10 p.m. on WGN-TV. Your pick may be Chicago's Best. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the Rick Hogan Show, called After Hours, otherwise known tonight as the Gwendolyn Brooks Fest. I have in studio with me Peter Kahn, one of the three tireless editors of a book titled The Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks. It's got a foreword by Terrence Hayes, who invented this whole golden shovel way of writing poetry. And it's Gwendolyn Brooks' celebration of her 100th birthday. And on the phone, I'm pleased to be joined by Kenneth Warren, who has a very long title, but Kenneth, basically you're a professor of English at the University of Chicago, to make it short, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I always loved it. The USC, you know, my uncle was an academic, and I just love, everybody has long titles. The U of C is putting on a gathering of more than 30 poets, musicians, and fans of Miss Brooks, as we called her. It's called Centennial Brooks. It takes place, I'm grabbing my notes, it takes place Thursday through Saturday at the DuSable Museum and the Logan Center. How did you get involved in this, Kenneth? Are you a fan of Gwendolyn's, or are you the title of one of your books, What Was African American Literature from 2011, is so provocative and intriguing on the face of it, I would put you on any kind of panel. But how did you get involved in the Miss Brooks celebration?
Actually, it was from several directions. I teach American literature and African American literature at the University of Chicago, where I've been since 91. I actually had the pleasure and the privilege of meeting Ms. Brooks, almost 20 years ago, while she was still holding the writing contest for young
poets
around Illinois.
Yeah.
The University of Chicago sponsored the award ceremony that Ms. Brooks presided over. She actually took the time to read through all of the entries, select the winners, notify the young poets and their parents and their families would be there, and she would give the awards. And it was just such a great, great event. It was really an honor to meet her.
Did you, my guest, Peter Kahn, one of the editors of this Golden Shovel Anthology, met her around the same time and was sort of beyond taken with her. And I met her as a younger man. Were you too? There was something so radiant, intellectually radiant and personally radiant about her. Do you must agree, Kenneth?
Yes, but what I mean, what there was also, it was an intellectual radiance, but it was also a kind of straightforwardness about what poetry was. She wanted to make sure that people weren't intimidated by poetry, but also respected it as an art. And so she was willing to talk to anyone and to encourage young poets to explore their creativity. I mean, she was committed to the idea that poetry could be a powerful art, but also something that was available to anyone who wanted to take the time to learn about it and to express themselves.
So you obviously jumped at the chance to be part of this centennial celebration on the Centennial Brooks, which I love the name. Specifically, you're going to be part of a panel discussion titled Chicago Race and Space, which focuses on the relationship between Brooks's work and Chicago's urban landscape. How do you think, I don't mean to put you on the spot, Professor, but how do you think she would be heartbroken these days, don't you think?
Well, I guess I would think two things. One is, I mean, certainly she would be very, very much, from what I could tell, attuned to what's going on. But my sense was also that there was such a great deal of optimism just in my encounters with her that what she would probably say, and, you know, we're going to have, I mean, this event, we will have her her daughter, Nora Brooks Blakely.
Sure.
At the DeSable Museum for the kickoff program and reception on Thursday, 7 to 9. And these events are free and open to the public. They're first come, first serve. So if you want to get a chance to get in, you should probably get there early. But, yeah, I think my sense is that, what kept her going over the years was a sense of, the possibility of making and remaking the world through poetry. And so I suspect that she would be looking through the moment to see how we get to the next one.
Well, as one of Studs Terkel's last books was Hope Dies Last. And I think so what you're saying is even in the terms of this kind of savagery that's going on, she would remain hopeful and hopeful of the power of poetry. Peter, what do you think about this? Join in the conversation about this. I mean, it sounds like you and Kenneth should be two people who should get to know each other with your affection for Miss Brooks.
Hey, Professor. I would agree with what the professor has said. The early 90s was even a more violent period.
Yeah,
I was a social worker then. So she was alive for that. From what her daughter Nora said, she would go into schools and she would stick around sometimes hours afterwards signing books. So I would imagine that she remained optimistic working with those young people and getting them to see how powerful poetry can be for the good.
Yeah, that's a really well taken point. Are you, Professor Walker, going to partake of all these other? There's so many good events going on during this 3-day celebration that you can learn about by going to arts.uchicago.edu/Brooks100. You're likely, aren't you, to partake of some of these others? They're so intriguing.
Oh, absolutely. I was fortunate to be part of really an organizing committee of other faculty and students who are all of them great Brooks supporters, and the staff at the Logan Center of Arts for the Arts was very much involved as well. And yes, we've got a great set of programs. One of the things we wanted to do as an organizing committee was to bring together scholars, poets, those who knew Brooks, those who have been influenced by her, musicians, just to give a sense of the range of her influence and power. And so we've got, beginning on Friday, really sort of three kind of scholarly panels, although not exclusively scholars, but we wanted to focus on different ways in which her work intersects with the effort to sort of represent and bring Chicago and the idea of the new urban metropolis into conversation with poetry. We want to look at her female contemporaries in an afternoon panel, and want to talk about the reception of her career, the sort of changing arc of that reception. You know, she was the first African American woman poet to win the Pulitzer Prize.
Indeed.
In 1950.
Indeed.
Yeah, for her poem Annie Allen, and then she was active and productive through the transformation of the rise of the Black Arts Movement. And we'll be looking at really the poem that, in some sense, most directly reflects that transition. There'll be a roundtable Saturday morning focused on her poem, In the Mecca.
Yeah.
Which is I think many people feel that that's her greatest work. And that's about a poem that takes up in the views of many critics, are sort of the turn, or the, you know, towards radicalization, or the radical turn from a kind of more, you know, powerful but conventional poetic practice in which you could see forms like the ballad and the sonnet, to a practice that was more focused on the interests of the Black Arts Movement, speaking directly to Black audiences, a belief that poetry could be a powerful part of political transformation, and I guess even in some sense a kind of a greater experimentation with a more direct style. So we'll have several poets and scholars reflecting on that poem.
God, you've got me hooked. You've got me hooked. Yeah. I mean, don't you think, Peter Kahn? I mean, this—you've made this sound astonishingly interesting. Especially, you know, it's the wide variety of it too, Professor Warren. You know, with Jamila Woods, who is one of my favorite people on this planet, being there, and Nora Brooks Blakely, who's Brooks's daughter. I cannot thank you enough for joining us, and I hope you. You knock them dead Thursday through Saturday, as they say, because I think this whole remembering Gwendolyn thing is a wonderful thing because she was a wonderful woman. But I think there could be, and I think this the whole Centennial Brooks thing, there'll be a great, great ripple effect. So I hope you have fun too, Professor. I hope you have fun.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, and there'll be great poetry readings and, as you say, musical performances, a concert on Saturday night. So,
yeah, and it's all free, too.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing you're doing down there. I know you're not the university itself, but being part of it is a great thing for you. Thank you so much. Go to arts.uchicago.edu/Brooks100. It's really a fabulous 3-day kind of celebration. Peter Kahn and I will be back after the news, and whether you like it or not, we're both going to read some poems. What do you think about that? What do you think about
Sounds
that?
Good.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Here with the news, brought to you by Walt's Food Centers, is the great Roger Badish. Welcome back to After Hours. I have another half hour with my new friend, Peter Kahn, a teacher at Oak Park River Forest High School, but more importantly, for my purposes at least, I'm not in high school. He is one of the three editors with Ravi Shankar and Patricia Smith of a fascinating, rewarding, entertaining, enlightening book called The Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks. We just talked to Professor Ken Warren about the remarkable 3-day celebration going on at University of Chicago for Miss Brooks. There's the April 12th at the Poetry Foundation. This book will be celebrated in poem and song, and you can buy it. And then May 11th, I believe, at Volumes Bookstore, a relatively new bookstore on Milwaukee Avenue, sponsored by Young Chicago Authors. I'll keep you posted, and I'll get the information and tell you on a show coming up. How did you, Peter Kahn, get all of these remarkable writers? And it's a, you know, for instance, I didn't know Elizabeth Berg, the incredibly best-selling novelist who lives in Oak Park. As long as I've known Elizabeth, I didn't know she was a poet, too. How did you, Pat and Ravi, select the people? How did you go about it?
Well, it happened pretty organically. So initially, when I had the idea, I wanted to have students in a book with established poets, right? I thought that would be a win-win, right?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm fortunate enough at Oak Park where they bought into poetry. And not only do they pay for my salary and an assistant who's been a former student over the years, but we're able to bring in once a year a master writing workshop leader. So Terrence Hayes was one of those people. Avan Jordan, Adrian Matika, Tim Siebels, Franny Choi. We've had an array. And through
now,
that.
Do you teach English or do you
Well, I used to be a traditional English teacher, but since 2003, I just basically go in and teach poetry.
Oh, wow.
I'm like a traveling poet in resident within the school.
That's great. That's great.
I'm very lucky.
Yeah, you are. You are, but I think the kids are lucky too.
Hopefully. I don't know if they feel that very often. But.
No kids in high school. No kids in high school. They feel lucky about other stuff, but right. nothing that happens in the classroom.
I started by reaching out to those people, like Kwame Dawes was another.
Sure.
And Kwame mentored my mentors and friends from England. So I first invited them, and then I also asked them for suggestions of other people I could reach out to. I just started doing due diligence and thinking about other writers that I really respect and like and as poets. And then I started thinking, well, what if I expand this to fiction writers? If I'm going to show that this form is really accessible and I want to show students they can do it, well, why don't we get some people that would be outside of their comfort zone?
You got Bonnie Jo Campbell.
Yep.
A very good fiction writer.
Yep. Julia Glass, who won a National Book Award. Richard Powers.
Right,
who's
right,
from
right.
Illinois.
Elizabeth Did you Berg. Have to, you must have, for many of these people, had to explain the golden shovel method.
Yeah, I mean, I created an email, and I got help from Steve Young and Don Scher at the Poetry Foundation and others to try to simplify it. And I would send that out. And as people came on board, it made the job easier, right? And once Patricia had written her masterpiece, and I could send that along. And then Don Scher helped me choose out of my students' poems, Natalie Richardson poem to send along with the email, which is a beautiful poem.
Oh, so sort of examples of how this is done.
Correct.
You literally sent Pat's poem. Were I a poet who got that, I'd say, well, no thanks. I'm busy that weekend.
I was careful about
yeah,
who I'm
busy
sent
that
to.
I'm busy that weekend.
Because it is intimidating.
For some of the, I have to think, Peter Kahn, that for some of the poets who are now in, and writers who are now included in the Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks, that many of them may not have been deeply familiar with Brooks. And so you were, in a sense, introducing her to her work to them. Is that right?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of all of this.
Yeah. You know,
for some, they said, oh, she's my favorite poet, and now I've dug back in. For others, they said, I had a cursory knowledge of her, and now I'm a huge fan.
I knew you real cool, and that's it.
Right. And then, you know, with some of the British writers, some of them had never heard of her.
Wow.
And
oh, interesting.
Now, They're big fans, and they've gone out and they've purchased Blacks, for instance, and now they've read, you know, a whole body of her work.
Oh, so how interesting that, is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's definitely one of my favorite things, to be able to expose people to Ms. Brooks who'd not been familiar with her.
What was, I think there's a section in the back of the book where you do have some people.
Yep. We have some non-Brooks golden shovels as well included at the end.
Yeah. And talking about how, thanks for inviting me to take part in this adventure. Wow, the stricture enforced letting go.
Oh, right. Yeah, we included some of the email responses I got with people when they sent me their poems, which were really, you know, encouraging, especially early on in the process.
Did anybody, just because I think the form is so interesting, did anybody write you and go, look, this is impossible. I can't do this. I can't make it. I can't do it. It's too hard.
Yes.
Did you get some of that?
Oh, definitely. And some people who initially said, I'm really excited to do this, eventually I'd bug them and they'd say, Peter, I'm really sorry. I can't produce something that's good enough.
Tell people again how it is done. The Golden Shovel means you take a work or a portion of a Gwendolyn Brooks poem, in this case a Gwendolyn Brooks poem, mm-hmm.
And run you it down the right margin.
The right margin of whatever it is you're writing, your
Correct.
Poem, the right margin reads another poem.
Or a line from
a poem.
Or a
line
poem.
From a poem.
Correct.
I'm going to Before we take a break, I'm going to read one. First, I'm going to ask you how you got Billy Collins, the former poet laureate, a guy who you could easily, any of us could easily have a few beers with at the Billy Goat or some other place, who's about the most accessible, and I would have to believe among the most best-selling contemporary poets out there. I bet his stuff has got to sell pretty well because he's accessible, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
How did you get Billy Collins?
So I'd studied at Southampton Arts Center where he taught, so I got a chance to meet him.
On Long Island?
On Long Island.
Man, that must be a nice place.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So I studied with Mark Doty, another National Book Award winner, and he was one of the first people I asked to write a poem. And Billy, it took 3 or 4 years before Billy finally sent me a poem. So I would bug him, I don't know, every 6 months to a year. Initially, he's like, sorry, too busy. I can't remember some of the responses, but finally he said, all right, your persistence paid off. Here you go.
All right, before we take a break, I'm going to read the Billy Collins poem. Now, how should I do this, Peter Kahn?
So I've been having people...
Should I read the...
Yeah, read
I'm
going to
read the...
The
right
line that's borrowed, yep.
I hold my honey and I store my bread. I hold my honey and I store my bread.
So that's the borrowed Brooks line.
That's the borrowed Gwendolyn Brooks line. Here is how Billy Collins was inspired by that. I remember those long nights when I wouldn't have and hold her in our big bed with my record player playing that song, Honey, Honey, Don't You Ever Say Bye-Bye and Head On Out That Door. But now I just sent the mile and a half to the store to pick up some things for my wife. No more honey, just baby wipes, butter, and bread. That's accessible, Billy Collins. It's a great poem, don't you think?
I do.
That's a very good poem. We got to take a short little break, and then we'll come back, and I will put the arm on Peter Kahn to read a poem. I can see how the kids, your kids, and they're young adults, but the kids in your class be so taken with the challenge, the creative challenge of this, because it turns poetry into something much more accessible, I think. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I've got about 10 minutes left with Peter Kahn, one of the three editors, along with Ravi Shankar, not that one, and Patricia Smith of just a book you literally have to have, especially if you don't know who Gwendolyn Brooks is. That's why you need to have this book, because it will then lead you to her and her work and her remarkable legacy here, because some of the poets in the book, some of the writers discovered Gwendolyn Brooks because... they were asked to do this incredible golden shovel thing. Is that a thing? Is that the proper word?
I don't know.
What do you call it? Form?
It's a form.
Golden shovel form.
Terrence created a form.
And the other interesting thing, Peter, is you were telling at Oak Park River Forest High School that a number of your students have used contemporary songwriters and contemporary rappers to do the same thing, to express themselves. Mm-hmm. Did you get a poem that you could not use for one reason or another, that it was just so lame or bad or dirty or
there were some that,
unruly
that didn't hold up as much?
Yeah.
Ultimately, I made a lot of rookie mistakes, one of which was the more the merrier. So I invited a lot of people, and some of those poems we couldn't use that were good poems.
How many people are included in them? I tried to count.
About 300.
Are there 300 in here?
Yeah.
And many of them, ladies and gentlemen, very, very short. Some are beautiful and long, but the one I just read by Billy Collins is not a long poem.
Yeah, probably 8 lines.
Yeah.
And again, some people took on the challenge to include an entire poem, and others just took 4 words and a line, and it became a 4-line poem.
Yeah. Do you write poetry?
I do.
Any good?
Not like Wynton Brooks.
Or probably Billy Cowan, too. No. Do you want to read a selection from?
Yeah.
Tell me what it is and why.
First. All right. So first I'm going to read a poem by one of my best friends in the world and someone who taught me more about poetry probably than anybody else. His name is Roger Robinson. He's based in London. He's from Trinidad. And when I moved to London in 2001, Malaika Booker and Roger Robinson had just founded something called Malaika's Kitchen, which was modeled after their mentor, Kwame Dawes, and June Jordan's Poetry for the People, where it's very community-based. We met in Malaika's apartment in Brixton every Friday night for about 3 hours.
Wow.
And Roger and Malaika taught me a whole ton of stuff. And Roger's poem is based off of Ms. Brooks's poem called Riot.
Mm-hmm.
And the line that he borrowed is, "Went down in the smoke and fire and broken glass and blood." And it's called Brixton Revo 2011.
Wow.
Right? So that's when there were the riots.
Sure.
And he was staying down in Brixton at the time. So it goes like this. In caps, hoodies, and bandanas, they went through Brixton like locusts, mowing a field down. Streaming from small alleys, they flooded in. Armed with bottles and scrap metal, they smelled the petrol in the air and the ashen taste of smoke on their tongues. They ransacked phone shops and darted in and out trainer shops lit by flares of fire. As thick black smoke billowed, they stood still and for a few minutes surveyed what they'd broken, the crumbled iron shutters, jagged stalactites of glass. Then, like stray dogs, they roamed the streets and thought what next they could do to pump their blood.
Wow, that's beautiful and haunting.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Roger, like Terrence Hayes, like Patricia Smith, reminds me of Ms. Brooks in terms of that generosity and spirit of giving, and Malaika Booker and Kwame Dawes. I mean, there's so many. And
sure. Nobody said to you when you were approaching them about this, like, yeah, how much are you going to pay? I bet some
I got a few.
Yeah, I'll bet there were some.
But not many.
Yeah.
Not many.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I've been saying at these readings. So we just had a reading in New York City at the Bowery that Bob Holman hosted.
Bob Holman.
And then at the Kelly Writer's house in Philadelphia. And as I was saying to you earlier, my parents came out for both of those, and you know, they instilled in me the notion of generosity and how to value generosity and model generosity.
They must have been blown away, to use an old expression.
Yeah. And you know, I think a lot of the readers appreciated the fact that I wanted my parents there.
Yeah.
And some of whom are their contemporaries in age. So that was amazing. But yeah, generosity is such a
theme. April 12th at the Poetry Foundation. Talk to me more about that.
Sure.
It's easy to go to the Poetry Foundation website. It's an amazing, if you have not been to that building, it's on the near north side. It's on Superior and Dearborn on the corner. It's the coolest building on the corner, on almost any corner in Chicago. It's just a beautiful space. What's the event?
So it's going to be a celebration of Ms. Brooks and the anthology. So Terrence Hayes is coming in. Patricia Smith is coming in. And Ravi Shankar are coming in. So
wow.
All the editors and the creator of the forum. And then we're going to have over 30 local readers, including 7 or 8 of my former students who are in the anthology, people like Reg Gibbons and Tara Betts and Avery
book,
R.
Yeah.
Young and Agochi and Kathleen Rooney. And, you know, I could go on and on. They're amazing local readers. Rachel Dwoskin, who's Bill Ayers' daughter-in-law,
who's
a fiction writer, who just wrote something about Derek Walcott for The New Yorker. So it's going to be pretty incredible. And the way we'll do it is people will read the line that they borrowed and then read their poem, just like we've done.
We've done, yeah.
And then Terrence and Patricia will have extended sets as well, and we'll talk a little bit about Ms. Brooks, and Ravi will talk a little bit more about the form.
Who is this Ravi Shankar?
So he is co-founder.
He does know that he has a very famous
I
name.
Think he must may have been very named after his.
Yeah, he has to
after
deal
Ravi
with that.
Shankar.
Hey, you don't look that old. Yeah, that's what everybody says to him.
So he's a co-editor and founder of Drunken Boat, which is one of the bigger online journals, if not the biggest. and he writes poetry and fiction, very prolific. And Julie Sheehan at Southampton recommended that I reach out to him. He had co-edited an anthology for Norton of Asian American writing.
I've got to think, Peter Kahn, that just organizing this book and then going about the horrifying 21st century business of finding and getting a publisher who might understand the importance of this kind of thing, that can beat a guy up. But it also, holding it in your hands can be kind of empowering too. Is this giving you any notion of further exploring, not so much Gwendolyn Brooks, but this golden shovel method?
Well, you know, it was quite an arduous task.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine.
We have the University of Arkansas Press. They've been great. I've been thinking about, is there a way of making this, doing a second volume, focusing on it more as a teaching tool and having teachers and professors with their students.
See, I think this book can function that way, though.
It's intended to.
Yeah, it should.
I mean, one of the things I love is, so let's say we take Rogers' poem, for instance.
Right.
And we would study that. We'd then go and look at Riot by Gwendolyn Brooks and look for the ways that it influenced Roger. And then we'd also look at Roger's body of work.
Yeah.
You know? And then we'd look
about... I think it's an incredible... This thing should be in every school. I'm serious.
Oh, thanks.
I'm serious. And you've done a remarkable job. And Pat's poem is really amazing. I remember the first time she ever performed.
Really?
Ever. We worked together at the Sun-Times. She was at the Daily News even before the Sun-Times. We both went over there. Do you want to finish this off? Do you have another poem you can read? You don't have to.
Oh, that would
but
be
if
great.
You have one,
yeah.
It'd be
so
a nice way to end
at the
show.
New York reading, one of the things that made that special, besides my parents being there and my co-editors and Terrence, one of my former students, Langston Kerman, who's now based in New York, he's a comedian now.
Okay.
He went from a shy kid in high school to joining Spoken Word Club,
stand-up
to
comedian.
Being a stand-up comedian. And he read this poem, and, you know, in some way, he got his MFA in creative writing from Boston University.
Wow.
But he hasn't been doing as much with poetry lately, and
he's
I had to push
money.
Him.
He's making money as a comic.
Exactly. I had to push him to really write this, and when he read it, everybody looked at each other like, wow.
Oh, good.
This guy
go
can
ahead.
Write poetry. So it's from A Sunset in the City. He borrowed the line, "The grass is forgetting their blaze and consenting to brown."
I remember that.
So it's called This Feels Permanent by Langston Kerman. I'm hurting the way trees hurt, the screams hollowed in some fallen philosophy, grasses taut like skeletons. It's been months since you started forgetting. This must be how trees think of their lumberjack. Yes, he is their murderer. Yes, he unwound their rings in a plaid blaze. Yes, he is mostly saw and jagged and spit and unmoved by bistro tables and hard covers. Still, he is consenting. I miss you like the dying miss the knife. Please, be anything to cut through this silence melting into brown.
Well, that is in the Golden Shovel Anthology, New Poems Honoring Gwendolyn Brooks. It was read by Peter Kahn, one of the three editors, along with Ravi Shankar and Patricia Smith. Just go online, the Golden Shovel Anthology. There's only one book with that title. Peter, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Best of luck with the book. It's a remarkable, remarkable thing. And the great coolest thing about it is you're not only introducing people to Gwendolyn Brooks through this book, you introduce people who wrote in the book to Gwendolyn Brooks. That's a great ripple effect.
Oh, thank
thanks,
you.
Everybody, for listening. Tom Hush, thanks for producing. Aubrey Mumpower, you're a genius of an engineer. Carl Amari's coming up. I'll see you next week. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. It's 11 o'clock, and here with the news brought to you by Penny Mustard Furnishings is my pal Roger Badish.